my heroes is kind of that Bun Hathaway and this type of guy. And I noticed that Steve was just recently hiring a new mayordomo for the Avenue.
Right.
Over the years, it seems like you would hire a person just about with a, that's got to go into the culture of the ranch. Now, or is that projecting? But it seems like who you hired was really important.
Well, that used to be true, but now it's very hard to get people who will want to go and live that far out.
Okay.
It's not a place where you can have school-age children, for instance. So now you pretty much hire who you can get and hope for the best. We're very, very fortunate. We have this one fellow who lives in Pozo, has a ranch in Pozo, and comes out by the day and has been doing that for, I guess, 32 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And he fits in perfectly, but there's nobody else like him. We just hired a fella. I don't know how he's going to do. We hope he's going to be all right. But it's a very...
It's a different climate now than it was
50
years ago.
We used to have people who grew up on ranches in the within an area that where we would know about them, and that was fine. But that's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't such people.
In other words, everybody wants the bright lights. You just don't seem to find the person.
Well, has to be a, really needs to be, let's go back. It used to be that you had a cook and a cookhouse and a bunkhouse and you hired single men and you fed them.
And you mentioned the chore boy.
They were usually guys who had some kind of a problem, probably alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And you kept the alcohol away from them, and when they were on the ranch, as best you could, and some of them only got drunk every 6 months, some of them got drunk every month, but they had to go to town and get drunk. That's all. If you got to know them, you could tell. You knew that old so-and-so was going to go get drunk next week, and I mean, what responsibility he might have had, he had to go. But they were oftentimes wonderful men.
Mm-hmm.
That was a source of men that you had. Then there were some Hispanic, what we now call Hispanic people, who were at that time, they were Mexican, Indian, Spanish combinations who lived in the area, and this is what they did. It's the only thing they knew. They were fine. Those people, their descendants have gone into the mainstream now. There aren't any of those people anymore.
Would they have had families? I mean, maybe over the hill, so to speak, that they would visit their wife and children?
They might well have had a family. We had one fellow work for us 10 years. He had a family in Santa Margarita. Didn't seem to... He went home every Saturday night and came back every Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed to have plenty of children anyway. And there were people like that,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were young men who worked on ranches for a few years, and then they, as they got married, they had to move into town. But there were a few whose families...
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, in any case that I can remember, have houses for families until after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
After the Second World War, this method of operating a ranch disappeared. It was the way everybody operated a ranch before then.
Mm-hmm. So this whole myth of the crew going to town and getting drunk, I mean, it has some facts.
Oh, they absolutely. I may have told you before, they oftentimes, you'd have some fellas who had worked for you for years. They did this. They would go to town. They would take their paycheck. They'd go into a bar, maybe they'd just give the paycheck to the bartender. And he would give them whatever they asked for until the money was gone. And then he'd call the cops and he'd say, "Old so-and-so's down here and he's making a nuisance of himself." The cops would come down, they never booked them. They'd come down and they'd put them in the drunk tank in the jail. And they would call us up or some other ranch owner and say, "We got old so-and-so. I think about noon tomorrow, he'll be dried out, why don't you come get him? Mm-hmm. And they never booked these guys. They had no record or anything, but that was simply a way it was. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, sometimes some relative, if they had relatives in Paso Robles, some relative would bring them out. Hmm. Sometimes they'd stay drunk for a week or two.
Hmm.
We had one, I remember, a fellow who was the foreman on the Canyon Ranch, and he only did this about once a year. He had a wife and family on the ranch, and but his wife couldn't go near him. It'd get very antagonistic, so she would... He was a good man. She would call my father, and he'd come down from San Francisco, and man was very docile then. My dad would go in and say, "Come on, Bill, it's time to go home now," and just go right home. And God, he would be sick for 3 or 4 days, and he's good for a year. Mm-hmm. So once a year, it was worth it.
Yeah.
There were a lot of those fellas.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So that's insights into personnel problems on the ranch, and it has really noticeably changed.
Oh, it's totally different now. Yeah.
This is a question that Jane wanted to be asked about. When you guys built the adobe out there at the ranch, was that basically, you know, the local men, they turned from herding cows to building the adobe?
My father had a fellow working for him who had been a rancher in Pozo. He came to us when they sold the ranch in Pozo when Jack, I think, was 36 years old, and he worked for us the rest of his life then. But he could do anything. I mean, he could build a house, build a barn. He was a good cowboy. I mean, just a guy. And I can remember when we were kids, we used to come down from college in the summertime. We always brought a bunch of books. This guy always read all our books. He'd had a grammar school education, and he went to work. Mm-hmm. Running, his father died, and his mother ran the farm. Mm-hmm. He could have gone to college just the same as we could.
Sure.
But there was no tradition of going on to school, so mm-hmm. he didn't do it.
Yeah.
But sure, he could do anything.
And you guys respected him for what he was. In other words,
sure.
As a kid, you were able to recognize here's a guy that...
Yeah, we grew up that way. My father would oftentimes, when we were little, pretty small kids, he would say, "Will you go and spend the day with Jack or Fred or whoever it was?" He said, Jack was always losing his tools. So Jack would say, "Get me the hammer." So we'd find the hammer for him. Uh-huh. And that would increase his efficiency greatly. Besides which, we learned how to do carpentry. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it was. No, we worked with those people and had... Mm-hmm. My father had respect for them, so we did.
Mm-hmm.
We just learned it that way. We learned most of what we... There was never a time when either my brother or I were the best at anything on the ranch. There were always men who knew more than we did and from whom we learned.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, I guess, sensible enough to realize that. That's still the way, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah. You can get there by managing
I still tend to ask people rather than tell them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was that? Did that go on for... I mean, was that a relatively easy, quick thing to build that adobe? I mean, it just went from one stage...
Oh, it took them a long time. They had never made it. Jack McGovern, he had an Indian fellow who helped him, but the Indian had never made an adobe brick, and Jack had never made an adobe brick, so they had to find out, they had to figure out it was adobe, so they thought, well, adobe, you use adobe soil, so there's a hill that's adobe. You go out there and get the experiment with some bricks, well, adobe cracks.
Right.
So that didn't work, so then they figured
put
out it had to have clay.
Yeah.
And then... that Jack knew that when the Indians made the missions, they had put mud and put dirt and water and whatever, straw into a vat, And they got in there and they stomped it around with their feet, mixed it up. So that's what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that lasted a very short time. So he built a box about 3 feet square, put an axle down the middle of it, put some paddles on it, and then they had a long sweep, and they harnessed a horse, a workhorse, the end of the sweep, and he went round and around,
right.
And he mixed the mud.
Right.
And then they shoveled it out. Every bit of that was shoveled by hand.
Yeah.
Later on, when we had a contractor build our house, which is adobe,
uh-huh.
But he had built a monstrous machine which automatically, they shoveled dirt in one end and it turned out
bricks
at the other. Or they had to put it into forms, but
yeah.
It was a mechanized system. But what Jack had when he built the adobe of the Avenels was a horse-powered horse and men power.
But it was, yeah,
it was very
clever,
slow.
Yeah.
It was very slow.
Yeah.
But they did it.
So the house there was, and that was the it was just one of the processes that was going on in the rain on the ranch. And
but he did. Yeah, they did everything. They went up at that time. There were some had a fire, I guess, for many years, and a lot of very large pine trees up on the mountain, and they went up there and cut down pine trees and dragged them down with the with teams of horses,
and then they adds to
adds them out. Oh yeah, he did it.
Yeah, so
he did everything with the help of this one Indian who was not he was just help. He wasn't mm-hmm. wasn't a very capable
yeah.
man.
Yeah. Well, let's see. We've talked about a bunch of different things, but I remember one time when we were out at the Avenels, you talked about you were kind of mystified by there wasn't a regeneration of oaks, if I recall.
Right.
That there are big oaks, and it wasn't cattle feeding on them or something like
we
that.
We don't know. Nobody knows.
And then you talked about, you know, when you were out at Shell Creek, how that maybe a 8 inch to a foot of soil on your property now was up on the Comati Ranch and this type of thing. And then you also mentioned one time, and I don't remember, but he says, you can go up there and you can see the influence of their farming practices that were done 50 years ago, if I'm not. And all these things were separate instances to me of you being pretty perceptive about what's going on in the land, and it's more than just good business. I mean, it's not just good business practices, but it's kind of stewardship of the land. And I'm wondering, am I projecting, or is that? Do you think that's true?
Well, I think it's true. I think it's something that we learned. We didn't start out by being so perceptive, but we had some neighbors. Particularly Ian McMillan, who was almost a pioneer in that sort of thing. He was an expert on the California quail. That was the thing that he did mostly. But he, before anybody else that I knew, he became aware of the degradation that was going on the ranges and began to talk about it, and we all thought he was crazy, of course, but mm-hmm. over the years he prevailed.
Mm-hmm. So he was really a mentor in that sort of a thing.
Well, his thinking influenced a great many people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it wasn't just you guys.
No.
It could very well have been Jack Varian up this and
I think that Ike's ideas influenced many, many people. He was a thorn in the side of the Board of Supervisors. He was always down there objecting to something
uh-huh.
which he thought would degrade the environment.
Uh-huh.
He was the first person I knew who was seriously thinking about that, he himself was influenced by other people who wrote on a national basis. Who was the fellow who was...
Aldo
Leopold.
Right, yeah.
Well, he was Aldo's son, Starker Leopold, who was a professor at Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And he came down. We were privileged to go quail hunting with him a number of times. But Ike associated a lot of the people. People like Leopold, like Starker Leopold, became great friends of Ike McMillan and came down and stayed with him. And I guess they learned from one another, really.
Was this in the late 40s or early 50s, about that?
Oh, I think clear on into the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. Of course, by that time, the world had caught up with Ike. Mm-hmm. What he had preached when he was a younger person had become standard knowledge then, but it, when he thought of it before most people, naturally, he probably read Aldo Leopold and others like that. Mm-hmm. But we used to kid him because when he was a kid, he and his brother used to go out with a guy named Kelly Truesdale who dealt in bird eggs. There were people collected bird eggs. Mm-hmm. And they collected many, many condor eggs.
Oh, is that right?
The condors nested on these steep cliffs over there back of the between the LePans and the Avenals Ranch, and he would take these McMillan kids with him and lower them down on a rope. They were fearless. Mm-hmm. They'd pull these condor eggs out, and Kelly would then sell them.
And they would do it just because they were budding naturalists.
Sure.
They didn't realize the consequences.
That's right. Later on, they were probably more influential than anybody else in the attempts to preserve the condor when there were still condors in the wild. Ike always thought that the condor preservation program that was instituted was wrong, that if they couldn't make it in nature, then they should let them go. Mm-hmm. Well, that's still, I think, very debatable. Mm-hmm. But he was not in favor of the program. But he did know more about the condors, probably. He knew more about quail and the condors. And then his brother, Eben, made films for the Audubon Society. Mm-hmm. Took them. He started out, there was a big dead oak tree close by where he lived. There was an eagle nest in it. And he set out, just sort of for his own enjoyment, I think, to make a film of the life history of a family of eagles. Mm-hmm. Eventually became good at it, and he took that film, and then many others went all over the world. Mm-hmm. So the family became very well known for their efforts in preservation of wildlife.
So you wouldn't say that your dad was he persuaded? Was he part of that? It
no,
would seem like this
no.
is before. In other words,
he was not.
He was basically just.
I think he was desperately trying to make to keep up with the money part of it.
Mm-hmm. That was.
I think the truth is, on a place like the Avenals, that when my grandfather and my father acquired that land, it had all been homesteads. Mm-hmm. The homesteaders themselves were desperate because they had 160 acres, which would run four or five animals. And so they couldn't make a living. And so they overgrazed the thing, and I think his land had been terribly deteriorated. Mm-hmm. Then they cut down a lot. They cut down oak trees to make fence posts and for firewood. And mm-hmm. So they really did quite a lot of harm to the place, I think, after it had been put together into a larger ranch. It was much better taken care of. It was much less overgrazed, and there was no more cutting of live oak trees and things like that. So they.
Yeah, you were saying that here they would take 160 acres, and they might have no water at all on 160 acres.
Well, in a dry year, they surely didn't. That's why they had to, one of the reasons, right. I presume, they had to leave.
So as far as homesteads goes, maybe 160 acres wasn't even an appropriate acreage. They should have been able to take 500 acres or something like that.
The 160 came from Kansas.
Right.
Or some other such place where it was perfectly possible to make a living.
Yeah.
You can see all sorts of places, even in California, where ranches that once provided a decent living for a family now will not do that. And it isn't that the land is deteriorated, it's just that the economic condition of agriculture has deteriorated to such an extent that it won't do it anymore.
Right. Yeah. And if you got the right land, you can make it on 10 acres. You know, if you
sure,
go get
strawberries,
acre,
that's different.
Yeah, and this type of thing. Yeah.
You have to have the right land, you have to be willing to work like the Dickens to do it.
Right.
Sure.
Well, that because I got the feeling that maybe that from your granddad that there was some sort of of attachment to the land. In other words, the way that he put the thing together and then basically lost it in the 1900s, and then he went right back and put it all back together. And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe there was some sort of a bond between your granddad and your dad.
I suppose we absorbed the idea that this was something very desirable to have and to keep and to pass down. But I don't think that they, at that time, nobody had range improvement sort of idea that people now have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was not part of it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's see, is there anything else that
I don't know
might be of interest? Let's see, I think we pretty much covered it
Okay.
The schools, you say, we really did. In other words, there isn't too many.
No, every school that I can think of.
Don't mind me. Just a little fly.
Every school that I can think of is here, but I will try to see if anybody else. There's some of them I wouldn't even know the name of.
Yeah, and they would kind of fit.
See, here's a school called Home, 1859. Well, now, who knows where that was? Maybe the school's office may have a record of where that was. It would be very interesting. It would be something that some historian ought to carry forward. Because I know of schools that have totally disappeared. There's no evidence of any kind. I don't even know what their names were, but I know there was a school there.
Yeah, and I think that would fit with the idea that maybe schools existed for several years before they became formally.
I think that's right.
You know, designated.
Yeah, I have some. You know, we have some interesting stuff about schools, but it's very, very sketchy because even one of the ways you learn about a school is the records of the teachers' institutes, mm-hmm. where the teachers got together once a year, and I don't know what they did, but that was what they did. They had a meeting once a year, and you can go down. They listed what teachers were present from what schools,
mm-hmm.
but it's not very complete.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be because I've learned recently about the whole idea of high school. You know, I didn't even realize that a high school was that was a privilege to go to a high school in the 1910s.
They must have gone. Shandon had the high school there. Now, one fellow who I know went to high school in the 1920s. 1920s, he might have had a Model T Ford to go in. He must have lived 20 miles from school. I don't know how they got there. Of course, a lot of people didn't get to go to school.
There was a Union High School in Shandon of some sort or another?
The first that I know of it was a branch of the Paso Robles High School.
Okay.
And they became very bitter because people in Shandon felt that when an item of lab equipment, let's say, was worn out in Paso Robles, they'd send it out to Shandon.
Right.
So they made a tremendous effort and got separated. And that was very difficult to get separated.
Mm-hmm.
Because even then there was a tendency to have the school districts bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, you know, there was a big push to unify all the school districts. And the state policy at that time was to try and get districts with a minimum of 10,000 students. Mm-hmm. Thought that was more efficient in terms mm-hmm. of administration and all. During that period, we got the Shandon. We were afraid that Shandon, we were going to get gobbled up again by Paso Robles. Mm-hmm. So we set out to get the school unified, which meant that the elementary and high schools were all in one unit. Yeah. And it took us a couple of years, and several of us just really devoted ourselves to it.
When would you say this was?
It was about the time my girls were in grammar school, I guess, so I suppose it... No, that's not right. We got it done the year Steve... Probably not. We got it done around 1960.
Oh, okay.
And we were filled with luck. There was a lady in Creston, Dr. Algy. She was an MD. She had graduated from Stanford. She had retired. And she was a very eccentric lady. And she thought that if we got our school district unionized, we would pay less taxes than she did.
Uh-huh.
That wasn't necessarily true, but that's what she thought. And you couldn't disabuse her of that, so she went to every meeting, and we went to dozens and dozens of meetings, you know, as you get by one committee and then another. So the final decision was up to the State Board of Education. And one of our members went up when our thing came up, Henry Twisselman went up there. He was sitting back and watching, and he said that district after district that was larger than we were being turned down for unification because they were too small. So he said, he made a calculation, we were going to lose 4-1. So, and they had set aside 10 minutes for Shandon on their agenda. So the time came up, and Dr. Algy got up, and she started to talk. And she talked, and she talked, and they couldn't shut her up. At one point he said, it's not 4-1 anymore, it's 3-2. And then after a while he says, 3-2 the other way. And when Dr. Algy got finished, they allowed us to unify.
Just by force of personality.
She just antagonized them so much. She was a very easy person to be antagonized at.
Yeah. Well, now, where did Gail go to school? Did she go to Paso Robles then?
Our kids?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they all went to Shandon.
Oh, okay.
All our kids went to Shandon. All three of them. And then we had two grandchildren went to Shandon.
Oh, okay.
And all five of them went to Stanford.
But then it's that Shandon, that when did the unified school...
Well, they...
What demise, when did that...
Well, see, long before they pulled away from Paso Robles probably in the early 30s.
Okay.
And then they had an independent high school with the number of, I think there were five independent elementary districts. Each uh-huh. one had... boards of trustees and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we decided that since we had more money per student than Paso Robles did, mm-hmm. we were a ripe target to get taken over. All Paso Robles had to do was to try to unify their district mm-hmm. and include us, and they had many more votes than we did. They yeah. certainly could have done it, but they were asleep at the switch.
They were stymied by...
Well, we got in ahead of them, yeah. and once we were unified, it was very unlikely that the state board would force us to merge.
Yeah.
So we got it done.
Okay.
So that's how we happened to have Parkfield was in Monterey County.
But it's
the closest high school for those kids, so... Mm-hmm. It's called a joint unified district because joint means it's across two county lines.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you involved in the school? I mean, were you on what amounted to the school board?
Oh, yeah.
Were you?
Yeah, I was on the school board for 17 years.
Oh.
So I was the prime mover in getting it unified. Don McMillan was the prime mover in getting it pulled away from Paso Robles. Uh-huh. Although he had graduated, well, I think he went to Poly, so I don't suppose he graduated from Shandon, but uh-huh. he had lived there all his life.
Well, I think I've got pretty much the information.
Okay.
I did want to understand a little bit more about the Stewart
northern part of the county that had to be because of the homesteaders that whose children there was a lot of families out mm-hmm. there.
Well, wouldn't it have been just a lot of these weren't too far away from the immigrant experience, and there's this mystical. Love of the land
sure.
and hope against hope that if I get my 160 acres or something like that, that I'll be able to survive. And
well, what my grandfather bought oftentimes were where somebody had put together three or four or more homesteads and then eventually couldn't make it, had to sell out.
Yeah.
Maybe they bought a neighbor's homestead hoping to turn a profit on it. I don't know. It was too long ago.
Well, they didn't have much to lose. If they didn't have much,
no, they didn't have much
in Texas, then what the hell?
Yeah, I don't. Well, it was the end of the westward experience.
Yeah.
After that, there was no place to go.
Mm-hmm. But I think that probably explains why they would take this uneconomic unit, 160
yeah.
acres, and try and make it economic,
yeah.
and it just didn't.
You know, some of them, you can see from the foundation, some of them built a pretty decent, for that time, house and barn and all. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And there must have, there apparently were people in the area who were specialists. I know there had to have been one or more people who dug water wells, because some of the water well, although they dug a well and they cased it with rock, which came out of the creek, as you can
mm-hmm.
see it.
Yeah.
But to do that, you had to know what you were doing, because they had a little barrel shape to them.
Mm-hmm.
Something like an arch, I guess.
Right,
Kept it from flowing in.
Right.
So there had to have been somebody there who was skilled.
In
that. Well, but that was no... No, you know, we don't know anymore who that person or those people might have been.
Mm-hmm. But they brought a lot of skills with them. Or
yeah,
was
supposed to be.
Well, now, did he take money to accumulate his property out there in the Wasna, or did he acquire, say, homesteads out there along with...
You know, I don't know. Bun had, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 acres out there. His sister, Ella, had another ranch further down the Wasna, not joining his. I've forgotten how big that was, maybe 2,500 or 3,000 mm-hmm. acres. Their father was a doctor, of course,
right.
and he had a substantial home and grounds in San Luis. So maybe the father bought it for them. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. But he had there were at least five children in Bun's level, and I guess only one grandson.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, that's
right.
Murray Hathaway Jr.
Yeah.
would be the only descendant.
Right.
The girls apparently never married.
Anita didn't marry.
And Ella uh-huh. was the other one. She didn't marry. I think they were both school teachers.
Uh-huh.
And Bun didn't. He had a lot of girlfriends who didn't get married. Cam died young.
He was the younger brother, huh?
Wasn't yeah, well, there was Cam and Hal and Bun.
Okay.
And I think Murray, the one who was the sheriff, must have been Hal's son.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I was thinking about Bun. If he had 2,000 or 3,000 acres out there, then that's a pretty good.
I don't know. I never knew how he acquired it.
Yeah.
But it was homestead area. But of course, he could have bought from the government too at that time.
Sure.
Because I don't know how early. I never looked at the records.
Right.
It used to be very easy to trace the records, and I don't know what became of those. One of the title companies, they had the old books, book was about that mm-hmm. big.
Yeah, big.
And each section was on a separate page. And you could go and turn to the section, and you could see every document ever been recorded against that piece of land going back to the original patent. It was real easy to check. I don't know where those books, what has happened to those books, whether anybody knows.
I think some of them, like in American Title, they went all to the maps and stuff like that.
It's all computerized
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
But for years you could go in, until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you could go into what became Title Insurance and Trust and go to those old, they had racks of those old books, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you could find out.
I do worry about the history, because there was a lot of history on those maps that even were more as important as the title insurance.
But you know, you can go back through there and you're ancestors, you can see where they borrowed money and paid it back, and borrowed and paid back.
Well, also you know, the location of stone corrals and adobes ephemeral things that are would be important. And I don't know what happened to those maps. I've heard that they, for American Title, they went to Bakersfield or someplace.
Well, the old surveyors' maps, original surveyors' maps. Of course, the county has copies,
mm-hmm.
and I have copies of the ones that pertain to us. Mm-hmm. So those aren't, I mean, maybe the original maps will be lost, just as the original, a lot of the original documents for the land grants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're lost, but I can't find them.
Yeah.
I have traced them to where the only place they can be is in the National Archives, and that means a trip to Washington. And
that's probably problematical too, you know, because
don't know.
Yeah, so
we tracked them. We tracked them from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and then they disappeared. Then we found out they might be. I don't want to talk to you about this. I wanted to find out. I wanted to get a map. There was a map with every land grant thing.
Right.
So. I wanted to find out if part of the Avenals had been included in the Pozo grant. And so I forgotten where I started with the darn thing. I went to the Bancroft Library, and Norman and I spent half a day there. We couldn't find anything.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very busy place. The librarians were busy, and all. So I went back. I was on the alumni council one time there, and I went out to the Bancroft one morning when it opened. Nobody there but me. So I talked to the librarian, and the guy said, "Oh, well, what this is what you want." And he pulls out a loose leaf folder. It's got all of the everything they have with regard to grants on microfilm. So I was able to find what they had. And first on the Kamata Ranch, they had copies of the documents. But I said, "Well, where are the original documents?" And the guy said, "Well, all I know is that the Land Commission stopped when it went out of business. They turned the documents over to the clerk of the federal court, San Francisco." So we called federal clerk of the federal court, of course. After going through a number, because nobody knew. Nobody
might have been burned in 06
nobody,
or something.
Well, finally, somebody said, "Well, this gentleman, very old gentleman who worked here all his life, and he comes in every Tuesday. So if you call on Tuesday, you can talk to him." So I talked to this guy, and of course he knew all about them. He said, "Well, after the fire and earthquake, whatever was left was shipped to the clerk of the federal court in Los Angeles." Called them. Well, there was no old person there. Nobody had. That was a total dead end.
Right.
The documents may have been there. Well, where else could they be? Well, they could be in the National Archives in San Bruno. They could be in the State Archives in Sacramento.
Right.
So they went both of those places. And these documents are not there. So the people in San Bruno said, "Well, the only place they could be, if they exist, is in the National Archives in Washington." Well, I just couldn't bring myself to go to Washington.
Yeah, it's one thing to waste a half a day in the Bancroft.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Quite a different thing to.
Well, Bancroft was fun.
Yeah.
You get into such. Most of the people, when we went to San Bruno, most of the people and most of the resources there are devoted to people who are doing genealogy.
Right.
They didn't. There really wasn't an expert on these things. It's strange that with so many of these documents, there are copies in the Bancroft, microfilm.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows where the originals are.
Mm-hmm.
And without a copy of the map or seeing the map, you can't tell what area because the descriptions...
The context is lost. And that isn't to say that those maps aren't in Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Washington, but they may be misfiled or not.
I did finally get, I don't know, Steve or Norma got off the internet, a list of all of the grant documents that are in the state archives.
Oh, that.
Which were far more than we saw.
Mm-hmm.
We saw all that we could find, and they were very helpful. They tried to show us what they had, but hell, there were 100 times as many documents there.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't happen to have the ranches that we were
just
concerned with, but they did. They just so even if it's there, unless you happen to get a very helpful librarian, you just can't do anything.
Who might have seen it or and had a kindred interest with yours or something like that. So. Well, anyway.